This is an eavesdropping conversation. I'm Juliet Fraser, and today I'm talking to Tonya Coe. Welcome, Tonya. So nice to see you.
Hi, Juliet. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So I wonder if you could take us right back to the beginning of your story and tell us how music came into your life.
So my first memory of listening to music was a cassette tape of Puff the Magic Dragon. And I loved the song because I thought it was for me. It's Chinese New Year today, and it's the year of the dragon, and I was born in the year of the dragon. So I was really obsessed with the song and listened to it on loop. I think I was maybe 3 or 4. But then music really entered my life when my sister and I wanted to quit piano lessons, I think age 9 or 10. And the teacher said that my sister could quit, but Tonya could not. So I'm very grateful to this teacher for saying that I should stick with it.
It's amazing how often it's a teacher who's really the pivotal person or the pivotal inspiration even for somebody continuing, because lots of people begin with music, of course, but sticking with it is a whole other story, I think.
Yes, and I remember really hating piano lessons, and we were really terrible to this teacher. But yeah, after that, I actually started to take myself a bit more seriously.
So you grew up in Hong Kong. So tell us a bit about the next years and where you were and what you were doing with music.
So I was only in Hong Kong for the first 6 years of my life. We moved in the mid-90s when a lot of people moved away from Hong Kong. And we settled in Honolulu, Hawaii. So that's where I actually grew up. And I think both places are, I mean, they're very different, but similar in the way that it's a very small island, but very multicultural. So in music, I was very voracious. I just wanted to participate in everything. So I, you know, I had my piano lessons that I stuck with, and I joined the Hawaii Youth Opera Chorus. So that was a huge part of my life. And we did children's parts in like La Boheme and Carmen, but also danced hula and sang at the same time. It was amazing staff that I'm still in touch with today. So that's where I really learned to love music.
Amazing. So obviously a very classical tradition at the beginning, but with these influences from the cultures that you were living in.
Yeah, and I think my family did listen to music, but more popular music. So my dad is a film director and producer in Hong Kong still. He produced like stage shows, so he loved musicals and like a lot of Andrew Lloyd Webber. Yeah. Yeah, so it's quite eclectic.
And you then went to study in the States.
Yeah, so I really became serious about pursuing composition. I think, you know, when I talked to other people, it was quite early on. I decided to be a composer when I was 14 or 15. And I think it was out of ignorance a bit at what that entails, but I knew I loved music, but didn't really have the personality for performing. So I just decided I was going to do something like behind the scenes, you know, like my dad, to make things behind the scenes. And I studied with a professor at the University of Hawaii, Don Womack, and he helped me to get into music school, which was my dream at the time. So then I was on the path of, you know, studying at conservatories on the mainland. And I started at the Eastman School of Music.
And how was that? What sort of atmosphere and what sort of experience was that?
Well, it was very cold. I think I had a low-grade fever for the first, like, year, basically. I loved it. I think I was quite starved for having other young musicians who were really passionate about it. So I kind of got all of that at once. And, I just went to all the concerts. It's not much of a freelance scene in Rochester. It's really based around Eastman. So everything was right there. And I learned about new music, more experimental stuff. But just, I think I got a really good education in the craft of composition.
Who were the experimental people that suddenly crashed into your life? Can you remember the reference points that kind of changed the way that you were thinking about music or about sound at that time?
I think one very important composer I discovered but completely just because I liked the way the cover of the score looked. So I would browse in the Sibley library and I was like, this score looks great. And it was Chelsea. Mm. And it wasn't any composer that my teachers at the time were very interested in, but I just listened to a lot of that music. The other composer that maybe came a bit after, which George Crumb, and that did have a direct connection with Ricardo Zamaldun, who studied with him. So I became very interested in like putting simple things together in a very complex way. Mm. I think that's something I still strive for in my music.
Hmm, interesting. So tell us a bit about your compositional practice. Tell us a bit about, yeah, how you think about sound.
So I think my approach as a composer really stems from my journey, which I talked about. They're really coping mechanisms for being far away from home or feeling like I don't belong somewhere. So I think the first part of that could be an interest in linking melody with memory. Mm. So it's like, on one hand, I just want to cling to my memories of home and try to recreate it somehow in my music. And then on the other hand, it's kind of the opposite approach, which is to abstract as much as possible. So I take like these little kernels of sound. They could be applicable in any situation, in any new location, I guess. So I think my practice is about those two things inevitably clashing because I am just one person. But yeah, I think even though there are experimental elements in my work, I still always want to cling onto that those beautiful memories that I have.
And how does that connect to melody?
I think the parameter of melody has to do with just my background as a singer in chorus. And I suppose in the qualities of the music around the cultures I grew up with. So Chinese cultures, Chinese music is heterophonic, basically it's all based on melody. And also I became very moved by Hawaiian chant, singing in the chorus, just the unfolding line of it. I just was mesmerized.
You've been based in the UK for a few years now. Have you got observations about the differences between the music scene in the US and what you've come to know here?
Well, I know I really like it here. Yes, I have conversations about this with many people. Though I think no matter what, I still wonder if it's just because my life stages have changed. You know, with every new place, I'm just in a different place in my own life. Mm. I really appreciate the fact that it's a bit smaller in the UK and it's possible to revisit relationships with people on a more frequent basis just because you see them again and it's easy to get around. In the US, I think, well, partially because of how things are structured economically, there is more focus on the product and the result, the final thing that you work rather than the process. But I wonder if it's also because it's so far, things are so far apart that you don't really see the process as it's happening. Mm. Everyone travels for their gigs. So yeah, I think it's just easier to have and appreciate the final product.
That's interesting. So you mean that the process is kind of is masked a bit because everybody is simply further apart from one another, and so it's less witnessed.
Yeah, I think on the whole, of course, it's different in a scene like New York where, you know, it's all happening there. Yeah. But because I never was based in a particular city during the years I lived on the mainland US, then I think that's sort of just my observation and my perception of it.
I like to hear that that you feel that the UK scene is, you haven't said this word, but friendly. It sounds like, you know, the idea of bumping into people and that the size of it has what you perceive to be as a good energy.
Yes, and I think I also feel more comfortable here because, well, at least in London, it feels very international. Mm. So I don't feel as much of a need to like fit into a certain particular thing, just because everyone is from so many different places.
Has that feeling had an impact on the way that you're working and on your process at the moment? Has that liberated you in some way, do you think?
Yes. So my husband says that I work like a worm in an apple. And it's something I aspire to, actually. I tell my students to be a worm in an apple.
Okay, that's amazing. But I have no idea what it means.
It's just to be present with the thing that's directly in front of you and just take one bite at a time. So yeah, I think with feeling of comfort or having decided that this would be my home, it's freed up a lot of energy for me to just focus a bit more and not to feel so frantic about, okay, I need to do this, because just like this hyper over awareness of what's going on around.
I'm wondering how the worm in the apple might connect to failure, which is not a very elegant pivot from me, but because it's the topic of the festival forum, I'm wondering what your thoughts about failure are, or if you've got any great stories about failure.
So as a small worm in an apple, I've learned to not eat too big of an apple or eat a poison apple. So as someone who's 4'10", my greatest failure is that in high school, I decided I was going to play basketball. And I did play on a team for my school. I was very fast and quite aggressive on defense, but I was really useless. And that was not a dream that continued much beyond the very lowest level team in my school.
That almost sounds like a success that you got as far as you did with it.
Yes, my mom was very skeptical, but she was supportive.
And is there any creative fruit in failure, do you think, as an idea?
Yes, absolutely. I think you have to give it a try. Certainly in my practice with bubble wrap as an instrument, I think it's sort of expanded and developed into, you know, me writing a concerto for myself and premiering that just because I didn't care if it was a failure. I just sort of kept doing it. And yeah, it's turned out that it has been a really fruitful practice.
Amazing. I want to know more about that. Why bubble wrap? You must have picked it up at some point and thought, that's got some possibilities.
So I had a roll of bubble wrap because when I was studying at Cornell for my doctorate, I decided I wanted to pursue some visual arts. So I had an independent study with an art professor and I would just bring him drawings. And one day we stumbled upon the topic of transparency and how I love transparent textures in music. And so he encouraged me to draw on transparent objects and hence the role. But approaching it as this musical instrument started when I took a computer music class. And the final project was to process any instrument. And in a class full of composers, I thought, everyone's going to do piano. I'm not going to do piano. So I picked up the roll of bubble wrap and just started rustling it and thought, oh, hey, there's some like cool sounds in there. And gradually over the years, I've taken away the electronics and just tried to expand the vocabulary of that object. And it's really led to insights into just how instruments work and how we can experiment with instruments. So I think working kind of on the two sides of, you know, work on bubble wrap and then writing instrumental music in tandem has been sort of my development over the past 10 years.
And how did you pass over your bubble wrap techniques to another performer? I'm imagining that the bubble wrap concerto is performed by somebody else, but of course, maybe I'm wrong. Tell me.
No, so I was the soloist for the...
You were, because you said earlier about sort of not wanting to be a performer, but so you are a performer of the bubble wrap concerto.
Yeah, so I was really traumatized by piano recitals in my childhood, but for some reason, I can perform on bubble wrap. It's like I found my instrument. I have the confidence to do it, probably because nobody else does it. But I think I am the world's only bubble wrap virtuoso. There is a balloon virtuoso, Judy Dunaway. She's amazing. But I have a couple of pieces, the first two pieces for bubble wrap with electronics that are, let's say, for not amateurs, but just any musicians who are, can be expressive in a tactile way. So those techniques are sort of less nuanced. But I don't really know what I would do to have more bubble wrap players in the world. I think I do have a very detailed catalog of the techniques. So it could be something I could work on, a treatise, let's say.
Have you had to create a new notational system for this instrument?
Yes and no, because it is so much my instrument. I've developed, I suppose, ways of notating that make sense to me. For the concerto, I did make a sort of tablature notation, just based on, because I play on a sort of like table. So it's like left side or right side, small or big bubbles. So that's quite straightforward. But so much of it is improvised. So in terms of the rhythm, I don't think it is possible to notate very precise rhythms. And it's also the nature of the instrument. It's quite unpredictable. It flexes. You just have to kind of respond to whatever it gives you. So in that way, it doesn't play very nicely with traditional notation.
I think I might need to book you for the festival, Tonya, to come back as a performer to do something with bubble wrap. I feel I really need to see and hear this now.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to. And I would love to play with other people. Because I think when I've improvised with other musicians, it's developed my technique. And it's just really fun to find those overlaps of sounds. So yeah, I'd love to.
And you're writing a piece for Eliza McCarthy. So you are this year's eavesdropping commission. Tell us what you're up to. Tell us what you think it might be.
So I think working with Eliza on this project is really like making a new friend while saying, perhaps saying goodbye to an old one. So Eliza is someone I met quite recently. We met in the dressing room at National Sawdust before she performed the piano concerto by Donica Dennehy, right before my bubble wrap concerto. And I wanted to write an homage to my electric keyboard that I've had for 14 years, and it's slowly dying, basically. So now I really notice the notes that are missing. It just doesn't sound anymore. And it started with one C, and it sort of spread very unpredictably throughout the keyboard. And it was really nice weighted keyboard, full size. I wrote so many pieces on it. But because it's weighted, I think as it's like decaying, the dynamics also become not only less, but also completely unpredictable. So some of the notes like surge, so it's like the loudest possible, and other notes just get softer and softer until it disappears. So I thought that's definitely a failure as well, just coincidentally. But yeah, I want to write a piano piece about this and sort of maybe depict the feelings I've had about, you know, the decline of this instrument I've loved. And I think using the sympathetic resonance somehow on an actual grand piano to play with kind of the emotional world of this situation. Yeah, that's my plan for the new piece.
Oh, that sounds great. And what else are you working on at the moment? Give us a bit of a glimpse into Tonya's current preoccupations.
So I've just finished an orchestra piece for the American Composers Orchestra with video design by Alexander Cuesta, who's an Ecuadorian filmmaker. And that will be premiered also in March on the 12th at Zankel Hall at Carnegie. So I'm sort of shifting gears at the moment. But besides Eliza's piece, in the autumn, I will be writing a new piece for soprano and an ensemble of toy pianos and ukuleles.
Great sound world, I love it.
And this will be for the non-piano / toy piano weekend in Hamburg.
Fantastic. A juicy little collection for the year then.
Yes.
Well, Tonia, it's really great to chat to you, and we very much look forward to hearing your new piece for Eliza on Thursday, the 21st of March. That's the opening night, actually, of the festival. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Juliet.
You have been listening to an eavesdropping conversation. Our new jingle was composed for us by Iza Otoya.